So I want to introduce to you Dr. Douglas Potter. I like him because he is from my neck of the woods. He's a Buckeye like me. He came from Dayton, Ohio, and he came down to Calvary Church as they started their seminary, the Southern Evangelical Seminary, and he was a student, graduated from there, and 3 years later was hired on as staff, and he is a professor, and he's been with them for 25 years, which is really awesome. He is the professor of theology and apologetics. He's the director of the Doctor of Ministry program. And so he enjoys reading, writing, running, and war movies. So Barry, you two connect. All right? And so we're just so thankful to have you here. I told you that you could have 30 minutes, but that's not hard set. You speak as long as the Lord leads you. We don't have to get the teenagers off to an event tonight, so we're here to listen to you. And then we'll have a time of questions and answers afterwards. Let's give Dr. Doug Potter a round of applause.
All right, thank you very much, Pastor. It's great to be with you. Thank you so much for coming out on a Saturday evening to listen to me, and it's just great to be here, and so fun to be with everybody, and I hope I can help you out, too. I'm not a scientist, so if you were looking for that, it's not going to happen tonight. However, let me tell you a little bit about myself. As Pastor said, I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and I grew up in the church. I grew up in a Baptist church. I was saved at the age of 5. I was baptized when I was 12. It takes a little bit longer for some of us to move into that baptism, so I completely understand with some of you as well with respect to that. And I was taught creation in church. And then I went to a public high school, and I was taught evolution, all before I graduated high school. So I understand the difficulties and the intricacies of this issue. In a sense, I've kind of been in this creation, evolution, quagmire or difficulty for quite some time. It's taken up a lot of my life, so to speak. I won't say I lost friends who were evolutionists because I stayed as a creationist, but nonetheless, we had our talks, differences, and so forth. And I understand also that the society context in which we're in, with regards to social media, with regards to documentaries, TV, and so forth, is all filled with this notion of evolution, and it is all presented in the context of pretty much being against Genesis or creation or things like that. So hopefully the time that we spend together tonight, or at least these 30 minutes and then long periods of question and answer, we can hopefully address some of these issues to your satisfaction, or at least maybe clarify some issues with respect to that as well. Okay, first slide. You're probably familiar with this individual. Charles Darwin wrote in 1859, or published in 1859, his Origin of Species. And in that book, one of the things he observed when he was on the Galapagos Islands off the coast of South America are finches who have different sizes of beaks. And the larger beak finches were able to do certain things that the smaller beak finches couldn't do. Bigger nuts, bigger food, stronger beak, or whatever, to do certain things. And he reasoned that this is a change that took place between the finches. His error was, or his mistake was, ultimately to think, and we will emphasize this at the end and the beginning, because it's the most important thing, is the mistake that he made was to think that these changes within species, which is widely known as microevolutionary changes, and every creationist I know accepts micro changes within a species, is also able to explain the origin of all the different life forms and all the different species that happen to exist. In other words, he took what was the study of what we might call biological science of animals that we see and extrapolated back into the past that the the same kinds of changes that took place could actually produce a brand new species. And that, I put forward, is the mistake or the error. He went from what we might call an operation science to making conclusions about that operation science of what we see today, and to apply those same conclusions to an origin science. Ultimately, it takes on a neo-Darwinian understanding of evolution. Now, what do I mean by neo-Darwinian? Well, that's just new scientific discoveries happen, and so evolutionists have to tie that into his original theory. So that's what neo means. This is the new. And I would put forward that there's at least three things with regards to what neo-Darwinian evolution is today. First, it concerns universal common descent. That is, if you can imagine me being a tree, plants, animals, and human beings are all in some way or in some sense related. Just like the branches go all the way back to the trunk of a tree and all the way down to the root system, when you go all the way down to the root system, everything has in common an ancestor, which is the last common ancestor. And so everything is related to one another. That's the first thing. The second thing is this, that all the diversity of life that you see that is out there in the world today, all the different species of animals, is the result of two things: natural selection and undirected variation or mutation. Then in a very real sense, the neo-Darwinian theory of evolution says that if the natural environment was different and the mutations were different, you would get different animals than we have today. And it just so happens that these are the animals we have because of the natural selection and the variation and mutations that take place. So everything's related, and everything that exists today is the result of natural selection, and this is the key, undirected mutation. And the third thing is, if you see or think something looks like it's been designed, it's only the appearance of design. It hasn't actually been designed. There is no designer, because everything that you see, all the diversity of life that exists today, is the result of natural selection and undirected variation. On the next slide. My question to you is this compatible with theism or a theistic understanding with respect to God? This book that I list up here is a very big book, but it's a very good book that objects to theistic evolution. And in the very beginning of this book, Stephen Meyer, who I'll mention a couple of times throughout this presentation, who is a historian of science, who has written a few books himself, and I'll point you to those as well. But in the very beginning of this book, he puts theistic evolution in what I'll call a quagmire. That is, theistic evolution is asserting three things that seem to be minimally very problematic with regards to connecting neo-Darwinian evolution, as I just described it, with theism. Here's the quagmire, or the problems he brings up with regards to doing that. And I think he's exactly right. This is why, at least the quick reason, why I am not a theistic evolutionist. First of all, he says that theistic evolution is either, one, logically contradictory. Now, why would he say that it's logically contradictory? He would say it's logically contradictory because it affirms, under theism, a director of all things, and yet denies any directedness to the natural history of the life sciences. So you've got a director that doesn't direct anything with regards to the natural history of the life sciences. That seems contradictory. Or it's theologically problematic because it asserts that God is the cause of everything, yet He is not causing, at least natural things, according to neo-Darwinian evolution, causing natural life happenings with regards to the world. That's an undirected, uncaused thing outside of nature, so therefore it's completely and just caused by nature. So, but when you read in your Bible, and it says in Exodus that before God parted the Red Sea, he caused an east wind to blow. God's causing natural things. The scriptural understanding is that God is involved in nature, not only upholding everything, but is also looked at as causal with respect to it. But there are connection with neo-Darwinian evolution says it's undirected and it's all natural selection. That's theologically problematic. That's deism, not theism. That's deistic evolution. Here's the third thing. Or it's scientifically vacuous. Because if you remember, you come across the appearance of design, but you can't. And under theistic evolution, you've got a designer and you've got the appearance of design, but you can't connect the two. So you've got a cause and you've got an effect, but you can't connect the two. That's not how science works. Science is always looking for causes and looking for the effects of those things. That's the problem with theistic evolution. That's why I'm not a theistic evolutionist. I object to it on these three grounds, at least quickly, with regards to the notion of connecting neo-Darwinian evolution with theistic evolution. So my argument for tonight, let me give it to you. Very few speakers that I listen to actually lay out their argument. I'm going to give it to you. This is it. So if you want to show me wrong, here's my argument. You can pick it apart. You can take it apart and show that the premises are wrong or something like that. Of course, I will try to show at least the crucial premise to be correct. So here it is, a worldview, and notice how broad I am with that. You can insert Christian worldview if that's your worldview. You can insert something else in front of worldview if you want, but I'm just gonna be broad. A worldview should incorporate well-established science. Neo-Darwinian evolution is not well-established science. Therefore, a worldview should not incorporate neo-Darwinian evolution. Now, the most crucial premise of this whole argument, and probably the most controversial, and by the way, as far as I can tell, and you logicians in here can help me out, the argument's valid. That means there's no fallacies in it. All I have to do is prove that it's sound. That is, the premises correspond to the way the world is or have correspondence to something in the world. Now, I'm not going to spend much time on the first one because I think it's pretty self-evident that if you're thinking in terms of stuff that you want to be in your worldview, you certainly don't want things that aren't well-established, so you're going to probably say they should be well-established. It's the second premise that needs to be defended, and that I'll try to defend it for the rest of our time here. And that is, neo-Darwinian evolution is not well-established science. Now, here's science, I mean in the context of what the hard sciences, the biological sciences, in terms of them arriving at knowledge. Now, I understand that this runs against our culture, runs against our society, runs against what your friends are taught and what maybe perhaps you are even taught in school. I understand it goes completely against all of that. But in all the years that I've looked at this particular issue, this is where I have arrived at. And I'm not going to base my argument on things I got off of AI or social media. It may be out there, I don't know. But I'm going to be basing it off of what I have read in books by Stephen Meyer, I've mentioned, and others that I've mentioned as well, of people that I think are have the credentials to speak on these particular issues. I'll base my reasoning and my argumentation on that. So here's my evidence, or my points to put forward with regards to defending premise two. The problem of first life is a huge difficulty with regards to neo-Darwinian evolution. Second, the problem of new life forms is a difficulty of neo-Darwinian evolution, as well as add to that, arriving at a sufficient mechanism to cause the change of one species into another species. Third, problem of human evolution. Those are my three main points that I will make. Now, I am interested in taking someone who perhaps is a theistic evolutionist, convincing them that neo-Darwinian evolution is not well established, and then you say, well, what should they be then? I'm going to point them at least in the direction of what I will say of being creation or a creationist, to hold to creation. And I'll do that by first making a tangential point to my argument, directing them to the notion of intelligent design. If you can give up neo-Darwinian evolution, recognizing that there is design, there is science that backs that up in terms of making at least an inference from design that we see into there being at least inferentially an intelligent designer. And that is based on science. And second, I will give some philosophical principles that support creation that I think provide a very strong link or very strong connection to being a creationist. So that's what we'll do. We'll go through 1, 2, 3, and then 4 and 5 for the rest of the time that we spend together. So first, the problem of first life. Now, there's at least 4 or so ingredients that most scientists would say the minimalist form of life could possibly be or possibly take with regards to the simplest form of conceivable life. You need proteins, you need nucleic acid, that's your DNA, that's your RNA, you need lipids, and you need one other thing with regards to polysaccharides or something to that effect. Those are complex molecules. And those complex molecules are all carbon-based, made of carbon-based elements. Now, we could spend a lot of time on this. In fact, I do, in one of the classes I teach, spend quite a bit of time on this. And we could talk about early Earth conditions and talk about the improbability within that context that these things would come about naturally. Because that's what a neo-Darwinian evolutionist has to say. That these 4 complex molecules need to come together in such a way, and it needs to be natural. And there has been work that has been done to develop what are called chemical pathways to getting these to come together. And they have been completely unsuccessful in experimenting with regards to it, or also even coming up naturally with the connection of chemical pathways. But I'm just going to give you the 30-foot view of this, of how bad the problem is with regards to these components, molecules, coming together naturally. It's actually not 30 foot. It's actually, we're going to go outside the universe. This is called Dembski's beyond chance argument. That instead of concentrating on what's going on Earth and talking about probabilities and what's there to work with and how much time we have, Dembski just calculates these numbers and throws these out. He says, look, take the whole universe. He says, multiply 3 factors together. Now, how you get these numbers is tough math, but multiplying these together is not tough math. All you got to do is add the exponents. He says, take all the relevant particles that we know exist in the universe. Take the seconds from the beginning of the universe, and then calculate the possible number of interactions that all those particles could have given that time frame. And he comes up with this number, 10 to the 140 power. That number is so astronomical, I can't even give you an illustration of it. And this causes Stephen Meyer in his book, The Signature of the Cell, to say this about it. That number, 10 to 140 power, that's 140 zeros after it, vastly exceeds the most optimistic estimates of the probabilistic resources of the entire universe. That is, the number of events that could have occurred since the beginning of its existence. So this is these are the 4 molecules coming together, given the entire universe could not happen, or at least it would be extremely improbable that it would happen naturally in any way or in any sense. The problem of new life forms and the sufficient mechanism of time with regards to change, or with regards to change and time. So we've got the problem of original life that is extremely improbable given the entire universe. Here we have the mechanism of change of one organism changing into a different organism or a completely different species. Remember the tree. Here's a picture of it, drawn by Ernst Haeckel, in which he, remember, we've got plants, we've got animals, of course, man on this tree, and everything is related. The challenge with regards to this tree is the fossil record. And so let me give you one of the main challenges that Stephen Meyer deals with in his book is this notion of the Cambrian explosion. In the Cambrian explosion, there's about 25 to 35 phyla, that's the taxonomy with regards to organisms, that appear very quickly in the fossil record. And there's so many of them that they've actually been able to calculate all the skeletal, take everything in the world that is an animal that we know about and take its skeleton. And they've been able to calculate how many different combinations of those skeletons there could be with regards to living animals. 80% of them take place in the Cambrian explosion. 80% of all the possible combinations of all the skeletal animals that there could possibly be show up fairly instantaneous. Now, there have been all kinds of explanations that have been put forward by evolutionists as to how this could happen. We don't have time to go through them all, but they have all 100% failed to account for the fairly quick introduction of brand new species. There's nothing before this that's an animal, and then all of a sudden there are animals, 35 or so phyla in terms of the category, scientific category. This is completely unexplained with regards to neo-Darwinian evolution. And then there's Douglas Axe and his proteins in bacteria. Axe wanted to see, given a population of bacteria, is there enough time for gene sequencing to generate new protein functional folds? Now, protein functional folds are like an assembly line that builds something. In order to build a new animal, you've got to have new protein folds. And that, of course, can arise out of, they think at least, can arise out of mutations that take place where you've got to have new assembly lines to build new parts if you're going to get a new animal. So Douglas Axe puts forward his research on this, which includes bacteria and their populations, and comes to this conclusion in the end. He's just looking for one protein fold. The conditional probability of generating a gene sequence capable of producing a novel protein fold and a function is still only 1 in 10 to the 37th power. Now, that's a little bit more manageable of a number for me to give you an illustration. How many of you have seen the movie Jaws before? In that movie, the sheriff doesn't want his kid to go into the ocean because that's where the shark is, right? So he says, hey, go into the little pool or lagoon. No sharks go in there. You'll be fine. We'll still watch you, but you'll be fine. Let's say to get to the protein fold, that little kid has to go into the middle of the pool and swim to the side, and that would be the chance that we would get a protein fold. But is there a shark in there? Or is there no shark in there? Here's the good news. The pool doesn't have a shark. The bad news, the pool has to be as big as the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. And so we're going to drop you in the middle of the Milky Way galaxy, and you've got to get to the edge of the Milky Way galaxy. The good news, no shark. There's no space aliens. There's no space monster in there that's trying to get you. The bad news is you're never going to get to the edge. We're talking about the Milky Way. That's the probability that these bacteria are going to produce a brand new protein fold to start constructing. And that's just one protein fold. That's a problem for new life forms. Then there's the notion of reverse engineering an animal. We are all probably pretty much familiar with the notion of DNA, in which this seems to be the thing that most neo-Darwinian evolutionists are going to say, that we just need mutations with regards to the DNA to ultimately be able to produce an animal. This is where mutations can happen. Sometimes they're harmful. Sometimes they're beneficial to the animal. Gets a bigger beak, can do more, and so forth. With the finches, back to Darwin, this is where the change is going to take place. The problem is it has fairly recently gotten a lot more difficult to put this forward as a sufficient mechanism with regards to change in the evolutionary time frame in which we are given with regards to the Earth. Why is that? Around the 1970s, it was discovered by work that was done with purple sea urchins, but it's referred to as the Developmental Gene Regulatory Network. And you say, what in the world is that? DGNR for short. Have you ever wondered how, you may not know this, but every cell in your body has all of your DNA. Have you ever wondered how is the cell restricted from just making cells for, say, the liver, and it doesn't make something else, or the skin for the skin? That's what this is. Developmental Gene Regulatory Network is the limiter that limits a cell to just make one thing and be that one thing, like the liver or the heart, or pick any organ you want in a human being. Doesn't matter. This limits it. This does not mutate, and it's required for the animal to exist. And if you're going to get a new animal, guess what you've got to get? New DGNR to develop the limitations for that organism in terms of what it's going to be. And there's no known way in which this mutates or changes. It gets worse. Epigenetics, perhaps you've heard of that. Epigenetics is what gives the three-dimensional aspect of the organ, or ultimately the parts of the animal, such that the liver becomes three-dimensional and your skin takes on a dimensional shape as well. You ever wonder how does it get that? What is the plan that does that? That's what epigenetics is. So the problem is like this. Let's say you and I arrive on a construction site, and all that's there at the construction site is the wood piled up. You got your 2x4s on the side. You can see it in the picture. Imagine the houses aren't there yet. No construction is done yet. You just got wood piled up and everything else you need to build the house. It's all there. And then you've got laying on the ground. I have to be careful how I say this. I used to teach drafting. These are blueprints, but now I have to say just computer automated design drafting sheets that are printed out so that everyone knows what they're. And they're just laying there too. And you say to me, okay, we've got everything that we need to build a house. I look at you and I say, what? This isn't going to result in a house being built. We need more. Oh, no, we've got wood and we've got the plans. It's going to get built. Let's sit back and watch it. That house ever going to get built? That's missing something. You've got to bring in the construction workers. The construction workers have to have tools. All that has to be there for them to build the house. That's the problem. You've got DNA. Is that going to get you a new animal? No. You need DGNR. You need epigenetics. Those things don't mutate. Some of the epigenetics don't have proteins in it. They can't mutate. So when you reverse engineer an animal, you find these things that are known today to exist, and there is no neo-Darwinian evolutionary explanation as to how you're going to get a new animal. That's the problem that evolution faces today. And it is causing some evolutionists to consider abandoning it, starting over again, because they recognize they're not going to be able to solve these problems with regards to it. So then we come to the problem of human evolution. And here I've got to give you a story. One day, Saturday, my daughters in fourth grade were just sitting around the house. I get a phone call from a friend. He says, hey, let's go to the Natural History Museum over in Gastonia. I'm like, yeah, we're not doing anything. Sounds good. Let's go. So we get in the car, picks me up. We get in the car. We drive over there. This will be fun. My daughter will have a chance to look at animals, read stuff, learn things. This will be great. So we get there and we walk into the Natural History Museum there. And you know how kids do. They run ahead of their parents. So she runs ahead of me, turns it. I'm not far from being able to turn the corner either and seeing her. So I get up there, I turn the corner, and all of a sudden I look at her. Glad I see my daughter. She didn't run too far. She is staring face to face with regards to, you know, the glass that's right there. And she's just staring at something. I looked at the left to see what is in this case. And I see all these hairy hominids all the way down the line. And she's almost at the end of them. And she's staring at ones that's about her height. And I think to myself, oh, blank. You could fill in your favorite expletive there, but that's what parents say when they go, uh-oh, I've got to have a conversation with my daughter, and I don't know what to say. Now, there is a lot to say about hominids, and we don't have the time to say it. But what I would like to put forward with regards to this particular issue is to dispel the notion that we are just in a line of hairy hominids in which we are just different from them by degree. And I would like to put forward that no, we are not different in terms of degree. We are different in terms of kind. That is, there is something about man, human beings, that is radically different, so radically different from the hairy hominids that you cannot get us from the hairy hominids. And that is this, the three acts of the mind. Animals can't do these three acts of the mind, and this is what shows that our intellect is an intellect, or a rational intellect, such that we are a rational animal, and everything else is just an animal, including the hairy hominids before us. Here it is. One is understanding. You and I have an intellect in which we can define things like man and mortal and understand those things, and animals can't do that. We can make judgments with regards to what we know or understand. All men are mortal. Animals cannot do that. And we can reason. In other words, we can actually put an argument together. Since all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, therefore, Socrates is mortal. Animals don't do that. Human beings do that. It takes a different kind to do that, and that kind is a rational intellect that I may have in common with some animals, a body that is animalistic, but my intellect separates me from them. In these three ways that I call the three acts of the mind. So that's my main argument to support the fact that neo-Darwinian evolution is not well established. So let me guide you, since we've jettisoned being a theistic evolutionist who embraces neo-Darwinian evolution. Let me give you two things, and there's more I can give, but let me give you at least two things that will direct you to being a creationist. First, intelligent design makes a scientific inference. That is, I would put forward that intelligent design, under the subject of science, is able to infer design. Now, this is not in the area of natural theology or anything else with regards to the teleological argument. I don't know if you've heard that last night or if it was talked about or mentioned or anything. I'm not giving you a teleological argument. I'm just going to be doing science that infers design. And it works this way. Let's say you were to come upon a monument. And on that monument is the Gettysburg Address. Let's say you're not familiar with the Gettysburg Address. So you walk up there, and you're looking at it, and you infer from this that the letters and the words, because they arrive at meaning, are meaningful, that intelligence must have produced that. And I say to you, okay, that's a nice inference that you just made. And we make this all the time in the world with regards to, oh, this is the result of intelligence. And we make an inference that intelligence is responsible for it. But what if you've got to prove it scientifically? William Dembski, in his newest book, The Intelligent Design Inference, written just last year in 2025, argues that ID, intelligent design, can be established purely on scientific grounds. And he does it this way. Now, I've kind of simplified it. He says, all you have to do, if you were afraid there was going to be math, don't worry, there's not. All you have to do is look at two sides of an equation. And if you can establish one simplified complexity on one side and probability on the other side and see how they compare with one another. And if your probability is very, very low, and your specified complexity is very, very high, then you can establish intelligent design. Now, all of this is based on what's called information theory that was actually developed in the 1940s under Claude Shannon. And it's actually very simple to understand the concept of it. Claude Shannon said, if you're familiar with computers and the binary code, let's say we've got one thing reduced to a code where you've just got a zero and a one, two things. Well, if you've got a one there, for example, and it could be a zero or a one, that's very low information. You've only got two options. But what if it's something that is a code like the alphabet, where you've got 26 letters and you've got an E there? Well, that E carries more information because it could have been 25 other letters that were there. But it is, in fact, an E. And so this is the notion of information theory, which is based upon this. So you've got to get specified complexity by reducing some pattern to be coded or numbered in some way so that it can be identified with regards to information. In fact, he goes through the math and does this with the Gettysburg Address. He comes to the conclusion that the specified complexity is high. And the probability I is extremely low that the text on the monument could be explained as a sequence of randomly selected characters. In other words, here he's got an inference to design and the math to back it up. Hence, it is completely based in what we would call the hard sciences. Information theory is very well accepted among the scientists. So here's his math, and I've definitely shortened his equation. It's a lot more complicated in his book. But that's what intelligent design is doing or can do. Now, you might be thinking, oh, this is great. Let's take a whole human being. In fact, he addresses that in the book. Too much. It's too big. Too information. We don't have the computers to do it. So intelligent design right now just works with things at the biochemical level where we can identify everything. We can account for everything at the molecular level, even down to the atoms, number of atoms that happen to be there. We can do that. So that's where this works. And when you do that, and others have, he's not a biologist, so he kind of now punts to the biologist, and other biologists, Michael Behe, for example, even writing in 1996, puts forward the notion of this, the engine in the bacteria that runs the flagellum, moves the flagellum, is almost so perfectly engineered that he can account for all of the components of that, and he develops the principle of irreducible complexity. He says there is no way for the motor that runs the flagellum to arrive naturally, because if it's incremental, it doesn't work. Take one component away from the motor that runs the flagellum, and it doesn't work. It's very much like a mousetrap. You take one spring, bar, I don't know all the names of the mousetrap, sorry. Take any one of the components of a simple mousetrap off, is it going to work? it's not going to work. Well, if that's the case, then you can't gradually build the mousetrap and you can't gradually build the motor that moves the flagellum that enables the bacteria to move. This is irreducible complexity. There are other principles that have been developed as a result of intelligent design, but what they're saying is natural causation can't produce these things or be the result of these things. Let me add to that some philosophical principles that will point us to creation and being a creationist. Because now I've showed you that neo-Darwinian evolution is not well established. I've shown you that intelligent design can be based or grounded in science and give us something true in terms of making a design inference about things as an explanation of them, at least at the biochemical level. Now I'm going to add to that some philosophical principles that if you accept them, and they're almost true by definition, then you should be a creationist. Number one, nothing cannot produce something. That's the first principle. If you've got something, it could not possibly come from nothing. There must be a cause with respect to it. Two, the non-living cannot produce the living. Going back to Louis Pasteur, we've known this. Yet nonetheless, this stands as a philosophical principle that if you've got all that is non-living, you're not going to get the living from it. Three, an effect cannot have more than the cause placed in it. In other words, on one animal that makes results that another animal results for is not going to ever have more than what the previous animal had in terms of its production. Four, the non-rational cannot produce the rational. If you give me all non-rational animals, none of them naturally are ever going to be able to produce that which is rational. You need something that is rational to produce that which is rational. Now, if you agree with these four principles, you're a creationist. Because that's what results from this, and not a neo-Darwinian evolutionist. Hence, I put forward that there is harmony between philosophy and Genesis. Now, we don't have the time to go into this one, and I need to bring this to a conclusion. I know I've gone way over my 30 minutes, so I appreciate that very much. But I would put forward that there is harmony between philosophy and Genesis, because we won't take the time, but you can line up the philosophical principles on one side of the chart. And then you can look at the Genesis text and see that the Genesis text fits these philosophical principles. And I would put forward that if you're a creationist, this is an account of creation that is in harmony with these philosophical principles. Now, I haven't done the work or the study, and I wish I could say that I have read all the other ancient creation accounts. Some of them I have read, and they do not follow all of these four principles of philosophy, at least the ones that I've read. So let me go back to the very beginning with regards to Darwin and his mistake of thinking that the beaks of these finches could ultimately be, that resulted in these different beaks, could ultimately result in a new animal. This is the mistake between confusing origin science with operation science. And my professor who I studied under, Dr. Norman Geiser, wrote a book in the 80s called Origin Science, in which he made the case, the strong case, that these are distinct sciences. One is forensic, and one is operational science or contemporary science, or empirical, that can take place today. So just as you cannot, if you're a detective, just as you cannot recreate a murder or what happened at a murder scene, you can't do it all again and watch it take place. What do you have to do? You have to look for clues. And we're dealing with a neo-Darwinian system that does not have a sufficient mechanism for change. And as a result of that, I would say it is not science, it is an ideology that is being imposed upon largely our society and culture. And they have incorrectly, ever since Darwin, taken the principles of operation science, empirical science that goes on today, and they have said, all we see are natural causes, therefore there are always natural causes in the past. And I would put forward that is not necessarily the case. There may be a lot of things in the past that are caused naturally, but when we have the evidence of intelligent design, and when we have these philosophical principles and other things that I could put forward, but I can't do that in this presentation, then we are dealing with the possibility of what we call primary causation and not just secondary causation. And that cannot be eliminated from origin science, primary causation. So when all is said and done, the failure of theistic neo-Darwinian evolution, I think I've been able to establish. Plus, the philosophical principles that agree with Genesis and some harmony between science and Genesis must exist. And I would put forward and can't argue here that that makes Genesis best understood as a historical narrative. It's amazing to me that if you were to go back to the late 1800s and ask a philosopher, a scientist, or a fairly well-educated person, what is your view of origin? They would have given you that everything in the world is eternal. Never had a beginning, will never have an end. It's just matter in motion. That later became known as the steady state theory that has completely been rejected by science. But all of your philosophers and all of your scientists and all of your fairly well-educated people would disagree with this verse of Scripture. Now, if you ask a philosopher, a scientist, a fairly well-educated person, they at least agree with the first three words, in the beginning. There's no question about that. The world, the cosmos, had a beginning. And I would put forward that scientific, philosophical, whatever principle is in harmony with God created the heavens. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, that was a lot of information. But we want to give you opportunities to respond and interact with that, or maybe clarification. Maybe you don't have a question. Maybe you just have want clarification for something he said. Or maybe you got a question about something he didn't mention as you think about evolution and creationism. I want to give you the opportunity. I've got like six of them. But I can ask him in person. So if anybody has a question, raise your hand, Ms. McKenzie.
When Darwin found the finches, he thought he found a finch that evolved into different finches, but instead he found different kinds. So how do you explain the difference between evolution and variation?
Yes, I think it goes back to the main distinction I made between microevolution, which I do not object to, that we're still dealing with the same species, and we might debate or argue over what is constituted with regards to a species. But nonetheless, we are dealing with variations that are certainly caused by mutations of DNA to produce new or enhancements with regards to the organism that would, meaning we're not talking about an animal not having a beak and having a beak. We've always got a beak. It's just a bigger one versus a smaller one. And this has been observed with regards to animals today in terms of their variations are the result of changes in the DNA and RNA with regards to nature itself. What we don't observe today, and what I have put forward is extremely problematic, is taking one species, changing into or constituting a different species in terms of its offspring. And that's where I would say the mechanism of change that is put forward is not well established.
Let me boil that down. There's differences between dogs and they've changed, right? There's all kinds of different dogs and they've changed and evolved. But there's never, ever, ever been any proof, any evidence of a cat changing into a dog. Jerry.
You alluded to that there's an absence of intermediary animals, you know, as one would maybe you could comment on that further, because that
sure.
seems like a big deal.
Sure, yeah, I'd be glad to. In the example I used was the Cambrian explosion. And the question put forward over a long period of time to neo-Darwinian evolutionists is, where do you find the development of these animals in the Cambrian explosion? Because before that, we can't find them. Many suggestions have been put forward. Let me give you just a few. One has to do with the first suggestion was, it's in the oceans. This was nice to do before the 1940s, because we didn't have the ability to dig into the oceans and see what's there. Eventually, they got the ability to dig into the oceans, and they're looking for fossils and fossilized remains, and it just so happens to be that the oceans are kind of turning themselves over, and nothing's been preserved there with regards to going back to that time of the Cambrian explosion. There's nothing we can get to in terms of fossilization because of the bottom of the ocean turning itself up over and over. They've also put forward that, well, maybe it was done in what were like soft animals, soft-shelled type animals that can't be fossilized. This was put forward actually in the 1990s as an explanation. The problem with that one is that we have found soft-shelled fossils in China. The Cambrian explosion is worldwide. It's not just like North America had a Cambrian explosion. It's everywhere we go across the world. We find this Cambrian explosion, and we have found the soft-shelled fossils, so that didn't explain it. Probably the most popular one that existed in the 80s, if we were doing this talk in the 80s, I'd have to be arguing against it. I don't have to today, is punctuated equilibrium, put forward by Stephen Gould, who basically said, well, what's probably happened is we ended up with a small population of the animals that isn't preserved in the fossil record, and there the change is made. And then somehow that gets introduced into the wider population, and the change takes on or takes hold. The problem is they're in a catch-22 with regards to this. There's a huge dilemma. You need the small population, which the species easily dies out in, and therefore it doesn't take hold, and you need the large population for it to take hold. This has been completely abandoned as an explanation within neo-Darwinian evolutionists. But I was taught it when I went to at least high school or college, my college biology. I think it was taught as a possible explanation, but it is completely abandoned today. There's three or four others, but they're all abandoned. There is no neo-Darwinian explanation of the Cambrian explosion. And by the way, this is not the only instance in which you have an extinction and a fairly quick turnaround. There's a few other of them that have been identified. We've just looked at one. So you have multiple instances of extinction, and then not long after that, you have a multiple array of animals that did not exist before.
So let me ask a related question to that. What about all these neo-men skeletons that they have found that are supposed to be a halfway link between ape and man? Can you kind of speak to some of those
sure.
that have been found?
That gets back to my hairy hominids, the line of hairy hominids. Now, creationists themselves will disagree over what may be human and not in that line. There are some creationists that hold that, for example, Neanderthal is just a human being. There are other creationists that say no. Whether it's Neanderthal or Denisovan or the Red Dragon Man, Red Dragon Man has kind of come forward now as being the category of modern man, even though it looks a little bit different, quite a bit different nonetheless. But if you go back with regards to all of those, some creation would say they are all animals. It's an area of debate. But I would say that this is an area of science that is very, very skeptical. Even among themselves, they don't have a good line with regards to this particular issue in terms of knowing where they can get from a common ancestor between, say, chimpanzees and modern man going back in time. They have not been able to sketch out what this is or what it's about in terms of making that particular connection. They've got a lot of ideas. A lot of these scientists disagree with each other. The hominid fossils are very scant. They're extremely rare. And there's even debate as to what constitutes a new species among them. One of the things that's been pushed back quite a bit is bipedalism. It used to go back that you could go, that you could, one of the things they want to do is to have bipedalism, walking on two, to have enough time and to see a gradual development among the hominids. But bipedalism has been pushed back to the very earliest hominids. And so this time for this gradual development of bipedalism has kind of thrown a lot of problems into this notion of how you get to bipedalism with respect to the hominids, because that's something you want, obviously, modern man to have. So there's no pathway that is settled with regards to this. And my point is a philosophical point that I made, the three acts of the mind, that wherever we set the line between animal and human beings, on one side, we've got a rational animal, a human being that has three acts of the mind that has a different kind with respect to whatever is animal before that. Now, there were early on, during the time of Darwin, some frauds and so forth that were put forward that creationists have. In fact, when I grew up in the church, I heard all about the frauds, and I can't even repeat them. And they were frauds, there's no doubt about it. But we have found a lot more hairy hominids, I like to call them, and they're real. They're not imaginary, and they're not frauds. There were animals that walked around on the earth before man, and they were bipedal. We don't even know how many there were. That's another presentation.
Because God used dirt and made man. And then he seen that man needed helper, and he pulled out a bone near the heart, not the foot, near the heart, to make that woman. And then, you know, the woman came. Why are they making it so hard when it's like everything, I really listened to you, and it's like everything like really went over my head, because I'm sitting here going, you know, all it takes is a sperm and an egg. So why do they make it?
Yeah, I have no problem saying in this context or even in an academic context that neo-Darwinian evolution is demonic deception on our society and culture to steer us away from the creation account and from creation in general. That's why it's so hard. That's why it's so difficult. I have no problem saying that in front of any audience, no matter how it's received. And that's why I'm so resistant against the notion of theistic evolution. Those things are not compatible on scientific grounds, including intelligent design, and on philosophical grounds. And I am making my case from science and from philosophy. I didn't quote one Bible verse till we got to the end.
Anybody else?
I'm not sure. I may be way off base here. You were talking about catastrophic events and how they changed. There are those that say that's what evolution created to, or contributed to evolution. And you're contending that actually this was just a course of events. They carried those same creatures, carried on. Some survived, some did not. That's what I thought you said.
Yes, and what I am putting forward is the notion that in order to account for an extinction, and then fairly quickly, a large number of animals existing and repopulating the earth takes a primary cause. So I am putting forward as a creationist that God is the primary cause of those animals existing after a mass extinction. And I am also holding to that God is required as a primary cause of human beings. That you cannot have a group or a pair of hairy hominids that are in any way naturally enhanced. And I agree with the Genesis historical narrative that God created, as was said before, from the mud, man, and breathed into him life, such that a primary cause, when I say primary cause, just plug in God, created man from the mud and breathed into him for him to become a living being, and that made a rational animal. The text, and I hold to the historical narrative of Genesis, the text does not allow for us to have a hairy hominid breathed into to become a rational human being. The text, if you take it as a historical narrative, which I do, and I realize I did not give arguments for taking it as a historical narrative, that would take another lecture, but that's one of the things to add to why it would take a theistic evolutionist to accept intelligent design, to accept philosophical principles of creation that agree with Genesis. Now let's look, how should we take the Genesis creation account? We didn't address that question. But I would argue the conclusion of that is, my conclusion is, it's best taken as a historical narrative. Now, it's got a slathering of poetry and lots of figures of speech. I understand that, but I don't see a reason to separate Genesis 1 and 2, or for that matter, Genesis 1 through 11, from the historicity of Abraham On, which is well established. If Abraham On is history, so is Genesis 11 back to 1.
Anybody else? Wrote down some questions.
Oh, these are from the pastor.
All right.
Uh-oh. I'm getting nervous now.
Isn't also the problem of theistic evolution, meaning that God directed evolution, isn't a problem there in Genesis, meaning that before the fall, there would have to be millions and millions and millions of animals, people who died, killed, blood spilt, all before the fall of man?
Creationists are divided on this notion of animal death fall, or even on this notion of how much time you happen to have. I consider that a question or an issue of models of interpreting Genesis. So it's not, while it's relevant to the talk that I gave, if you go on and start asking questions about Genesis, which I know is a natural place to go, But there are differences among creationists with regards to how to interpret the Genesis creation account, and differences among creationists with regards to the age of the earth and the time that happens to be involved. And I actually teach a class called Creation Models. I'm teaching it this semester. It's only the second time that I've taught it. And we go through, believe it or not, about 10 or 11 acceptable, well, I won't say they're all acceptable. Let me narrow that down to about 8 or so models that interpret the Genesis creation account from various creationists. Just to give you, because you mentioned evil and all the animal death and stuff that went before that, one of the views is by Bill Dembski, and his particular view says that the fall is front-loaded into the very beginning, so that when Adam and Eve are cast out of the garden, they face the consequences of the fall already. In the garden, they face no consequences, and that's where they're tested. They go out of the garden, and they face. So that's one possible interpretation among many. I can't go through all the models, and I can't assess them in terms of strengths and weaknesses. That's what a class does with regards to that. So I would just say that among creationists, there are various views on that particular issue.
And then I think it's one of the most interesting things, one thing I get questioned on all the time. Fact is, even man, who has a lab and able to control the environment to the best of its ability and putting amino acids and all the things that were needed to create life, and all our scientific brilliance have not been able to create what is needed to create life.
Right.
And yet we're supposed to accept that it happened out in the world by accident, by chance, right?
Yeah, Yeah. Again, back to Dembski's argument. The reason I like Dembski's argument is not just its rhetorical effect. It considers the whole universe in terms of probability of these things coming together, given all the particles that exist and all the possible interactions that can take place, is extremely improbable that it's ever going to happen naturally. It will take intelligence, God, to do a miracle in terms of producing first life. And that should not be considered something that's unscientific, because if I say, well, I can posit God doing something there because I have an atheistic worldview, and a neo-Darwinian evolutionist who maybe is atheistic says, well, and most of science is dominated by this notion of just looking at secondary causes as explanations of things, because that's what it's come down to be in terms of how the science operates. But that's, you don't discover whether there's secondary causes or even primary causes by science alone. You've got on top of that a philosophical framework that is either theistic or atheistic, where those questions are actually decided. And so, since most scientists and much of our media, society, and culture just works under a naturalistic view of the world, only looking to secondary causes of explanations of things, I just reject that whole framework. Why? See Dr. Howe's lecture.
Yeah. You have more chance of a hurricane going through a trailer park and creating the Mona Lisa than life being formed by accident. I'm sorry. All right. One more question, then we'll close.
Well, honestly, evolution requires these huge amounts of time for things to happen, right? And it categorizes how things are happening. So what about the recent findings of soft dinosaur tissue or footprint of a man along with a dinosaur? That seems like empirical evidence that destroys 60 million years for something to happen.
Man, so the first part of your question was, does time help evolution? My argument here was, no, it doesn't. Why? Whether it's the origin of life, look at Dempsey's argument that we gave. For one animal to change into another animal, look at the bacteria work that Douglas Axe did. And then reverse engineer an animal, and you realize it doesn't matter how much time I give evolution, it doesn't have enough time to even do one protein fold. Because the chance of that happening is to drop you in the galaxy and tell you to get to the edge of it. You're never going to do it. Now, the second part of your question with regards to the notion of soft tissue in dinosaurs and how to interpret that, or the possibility of dinosaurs living at the same time of humans, I would punt that to the creation model class, because creationists are going to differ on that, at least in terms of whether or not dinosaurs were at the same time as human beings, or whether or not old Earth creationists can prevail, saying that dinosaurs were well before that time. There have been explanations as to how that DNA is preserved in those soft tissues over that long period of time that have been put forward by scientists, whether you buy into that or not. And also with regards to the explanations of the footprints, alternative explanations exist with regards to that as well. And I'll just leave it at that. Yeah, which is another talk, by the way.
All right. Have you appreciated his time that he's given us today? Thank you so, so
sure.
much.
Thank you.